Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. My co-host, Meghna Chakrabarty, is out today. In the news this week, an executive order from President Obama ending deportation of many undocumented immigrants. The policy change will affect hundreds of thousands of younger immigrants and heat up an election year debate over immigration.
Effective immediately, the Department of Homeland Security is taking steps to lift the shadow of deportation from these young people.
Meanwhile, in the race for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts this week, ask not what you can do for your country, but what you did for your kids.
Scott did all the morning routine. Get the girls up, get them fed, get them dressed.
Also, Massachusetts unemployment dropped to a three-year low, while the Boston housing market showed signs of finally hitting bottom.
The Massachusetts economy continues to be in very good shape, and we're doing everything we can to help it along.
And the longtime companion of James Whitey Bulger was sentenced to 8 years for harboring the Boston mob fugitive.
Ms. Gregg was no victim. She made choices of her own free will. So as a result, now she's paying the price.
So those are some of the big stories topping this week's news. And joining us now to discuss them are two stalwarts of our Week in Review panel, Joan Vinocki, columnist of the Boston Globe. Nice to see you in person, Joan.
Nice to be here in person.
And John Carroll, mass communications professor at Boston University and author of the Campaign Outsider blog. Great to see you, John.
Nice to be here, Anthony.
So let's start with the news out of Washington that broke just moments ago that will affect hundreds of thousands of immigrants across the country and across Massachusetts. Just a short while ago, President Obama announced an executive order that will allow immigrants who came to the U.S. illegally as children to obtain work permits and avoid deportation. The policy applies to people under 30 who arrived in the U.S. before they turned 16. Here's the president speaking a short while ago in the White House Rose Garden.
Let's be clear. This is not amnesty. This is not immunity. This is not a path to citizenship. It's not a permanent fix. This is a temporary stopgap measure that lets us focus our resources wisely while giving a degree of relief and hope to talented, driven, patriotic young people.
The executive order takes effect immediately, and in many ways it resembles the DREAM Act, which provided a path towards citizenship for certain young illegal immigrants, but was blocked by Congress in 2010. So obviously, Joan, let me start with you. This will be welcomed by key immigrant groups in an election year. How do you assess the significance of this move by President Obama?
Well, I think it's fairly transparent that it's a path to votes. It may not be a path to citizenship, but he's hoping that it will bring him votes. And I think, you know, he's trying to make the move before Romney via Marco Rubio made a move that softened his position on immigration. And I guess tactically, it's pretty smart.
Republicans are already calling this an election year gambit. How's this going to play on the campaign trail, John?
I think it's going to be an issue they're going to pound away on, because a year ago, he said he couldn't do this. He said, I don't have the power to do that. Huh. And all of a sudden, now he's magically discovered the power. I mean, it's not amnesty, it's not immunity, it's opportunity. And I think what he sees here is a way to sort of burnish his image with the Latino community. When you look at some numbers, they're interesting numbers. There was a poll that just came out a couple of weeks ago that showed that among Latinos, Obama was leading Romney 61% to 27%. But on the issue of deportation, 59% of Latinos disapprove of his handling of deportation, because he's sending a lot of people out of the country. They deported almost 400,000 people last year, and they're on track to do the same this year. So I think he's got sort of some issues with the Latino, or the Latino community has issues with him that he's trying to address.
If you look at it just from a pragmatic point of view, he's flipping or flopping in a way that may get him votes. Mitt Romney, if you remember, in 2007, actually supported the DREAM Act. He's moved from that to, during the debates, he talked about self-deporting, which is not exactly a winning strategy. So, yeah, I mean, it's transparent, it's political, it's all those things. But if it gets him votes, I guess he's thinking it's worth it.
And what about the issue? I mean, he lays himself open to charges by folks in Congress that he's sidestepping Congress, sidestepping the will of the American people. Does that hold any water at all? John?
Well, I think it does. I think that there's going to be a lot of talk about him sort of grabbing powers that he doesn't quite have, and that he, as I said before, I mean, he said last year he didn't have the mm-hmm. power. So all of a sudden, he does have the power. I think it leaves him open to a lot of criticism from congressional members.
Particularly, it sort of dovetails with the argument against the Health Care Reform Act, too, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Seizing
sure.
power.
Interesting. Well, let's move on to the race for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts and the new batch of political ads released this week by the incumbent, Scott Brown, Senator Scott Brown, and his Democratic challenger, Elizabeth Warren. Here's a snippet from Warren's ad, in one of her ads, in which she hits her favorite topic, the assault on the middle class.
You work your heart out to buy a house, then watch its value disappear. You save to put your kids through school, then the debt just about crushes you. Families are getting hammered, and Washington's got it all wrong.
And for his part, Senator Scott Brown released a pair of ads casting him as a liberated husband and father who did the laundry, got his daughters ready for school, while his wife, Gail Huff, was busy working as a TV reporter.
Scott did all the morning routine, get the girls up, get them fed, get them dressed, get them off to school. He did everything with the kids, and he was the one that was always there during the day. If the kids had a problem, they didn't call me, they called Dad, because Dad was the one that was always there, and he still is.
John Carroll, what's your take on this recent ad buy? What does it say about the race so far?
I'm really taken aback by this spasm of positivity in the race. I think that
what are we to make of it?
It's disturbing in many ways. I think that that one of the things that the People's Pledge has done is sort of which was keep the outside independent expenditure groups out, is to sort of push both candidates toward positive advertising. Elizabeth Warren wants to talk about anything except Native American mm-hmm. stuff. So she's going back to all the populist issues that are sort of her bread and butter, schools, housing, Medicare, all of that. Scott Brown, I think, is doing something interesting. I think he's trying to inoculate himself in terms of public image of him, especially for the debates. I think it's going to be very tough for him to sort of find that middle ground, that sort of navigate that sort of high wire act of being aggressive and confrontational with Elizabeth Warren without seeming like a bully. I mean, this has happened to a lot. So I think that what he's doing is trying to create this image that will serve him down the road, not necessarily just for now.
Well, Joan, are you surprised at all? I mean, I'm just considering though that ad we just heard from Scott Brown. He used this regular guy image and the brown jacket and the pickup truck to great effect to get elected. Is it still a winning card for him to play? I mean, that seems to be what he's doing. The regular guy, he's folding laundry, he takes care of his kids. I mean, what a guy. Keep him in office.
Well, I think it does work up to a point. He did run on a very positive ad campaign the last time around. We make a lot of fun of the jacket and the truck, and mm-hmm. It's lost some of its luster. But the thing that people like about him is that he is a nice guy. And I think he does run the risk, as John pointed out, of, if he undermines that image, what's left? The votes. And they may not be quite as palatable to the Massachusetts electorate. On the other hand, the Elizabeth Warren ad is very earnest. I'm still waiting to hear how she's going to unhammer the middle class. I mean, they've been hammered, but I'm not sure what she's actually proposing there.
Well, I think that's a great point. And in fact, both these ads, I was struck this week, make a very little effort to talk about actual policies, as you say, how to unhammer the middle class or do something more than fold your daughter's laundry. I mean,
Let's not be too critical of the Mr. Mom approach to domestic chores. I mean, I think there's something to be said for that.
I think Brian McGrory, my colleague, pointed out in a column today a really fun point, that only when you work on Beacon Hill can you be home, at home to take care of your children.
Always there during the day, right? I mean, wasn't he on the taxpayer dime when he was always there during the day?
When she was hard at work for Channel 5.
Exactly.
Joan, you wrote this week about the pact that Brown and Warren signed to ban out-of-state spending on attack ads to keep them out of this race. And you suggest this is something that the Brown team might be regretting now? Why?
Well, I mean, I think his hands are tied. If he does something negative under the pact, it'll have to be under his own name. And to get back to, you know, John's point, he comes off as not Mr. Nice Guy and a bit of a bully. So it, you know, it really puts him kind of in a strategic bind right now, I think.
And financially, too, I think, you know, he would love to have some of those resources from Karl Rove's, super PACs and from the other folks. Look at, Sheldon Adelson is tossing $10 million around like it's nickels at this point. I think that would be, for him, it would be able, as John says, to do all his dirty work. I think the longer this thing goes on, the harder it would be, the People's Pledge, the harder it would be to get out of this pact. Because I think that people would look at it as a sort of a transparent ploy. You'd have to come up, you'd have to, you know, trick up some reason to get out of it. And I think it's like handcuffs. You know, the more you struggle to get out of them, the tighter they can get.
On the other hand, I think if they think that that's what it's going to take to win, they'll do it. And then, you know, one side does it, the other side does it, and all of a sudden the ads get a lot more interesting.
Yeah, that's true, and a lot more of them as well.
All right, well, let's move on to some economic news this week. A pair of economic reports came out yesterday showing signs of an improving state economy. First, Massachusetts unemployment dropped to 6%. That's the lowest it's been in more than 3 years. The second item, a new report from Harvard, says the Boston housing market has probably found the bottom and will start improving. Here's Governor Deval Patrick reacting to the news.
It is happening because in addition to making the hard choices we have in terms of reforming government, we've also invested in things we know make a difference in education, in innovation, and in infrastructure.
First of all, Joan, can Governor Patrick take some of the credit for this?
Well, it's like everything else. When there's good news on your watch, you know, you take the credit. And Massachusetts has been ahead of the rest of the country on this issue. You know, it helped get Deval Patrick reelected way back when we were doing better and seemed to have turned the corner. So, you know, it's a continuing good news story for him. I'm not sure it tells the whole picture of the economy for everybody in Massachusetts. Young people under 25, you know, older people over 55, I think, are, you know, still out of work and looking for jobs.
Yeah, what's your take, John?
There's a Globe piece talked about how a lot of these jobs, also these hires, are temporary hires, and that may tell you something about sort of the overall level of confidence that the business community has. I think that there are areas that are not doing well. Finance is flat, healthcare is flat, higher education is flat. So there are some areas that are doing better than others, that are profiting more than others. But I think, you know, from a standpoint of confidence, I think overall it would give people a sense that the state is moving in the right direction.
Well, despite these positive indicators, one group that's still struggling is the younger adults. We did a piece earlier this week, a discussion about those folks between the ages of 25 and 34 who are dropping out of this housing market that's supposedly improving. We spoke to Michael Goodman, a professor of public policy at UMass Dartmouth. Here he is.
About two-thirds of our population has less than a college degree. And for those less well-educated residents, particularly those folks who are younger, don't have experience, didn't already have a job, the prices are still in a very real sense out of reach for many people who don't earn a solid income, let alone have the credit that's now required to qualify for one of these low interest rate mortgages.
I mean, some of the statistics that came out of the Federal Reserve about the percentage of these younger adults who are being locked out and really falling away from that sort of American dream of home ownership is quite astounding. So this all leads to a question: if these numbers are hiding the difficulty that many young folks across Massachusetts continue to face and will continue to face even in a post-recession economy.
Well, I think there's enough anecdotal evidence to suggest that, you know, the numbers don't tell the whole story. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of parents who have, you know, children who have moved back in and they're tripping over their son's, you know, like size 12 sneakers and thinking, gee, I don't know what the numbers mean, but, you know, it hasn't worked for my kid.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what Mitt Romney ad uses. I can't remember actually if it's a Romney ad or a Super
PAC. The sneakers?
The kids moving back in with the parents and the mom saying, you know, I loved having the kids around, but not so much now. And it's all because Barack Obama failed us. So that's it's out there. The other bad news is how bad a rental market this is. Forbes just did a study, and we're the fifth worst city for renters in the country. New York is the first, so, you know, for once we beat New York. I think that they're getting, young people are getting squeezed on both ends, and I think that that's part of the reason that there's a migration out of Massachusetts that continues to be pretty steady and significant.
And even the people that have jobs, you know, even the young people that have jobs, they have, a lot of them have low-paying internships. You know, these companies have found ways to, you know, have temporary workers without benefits, and it really makes it hard to earn the kind of wage that would let you, you know, rent or buy a house, that's for sure.
Well, as journalists, if our job is to sort of balance the news, I think we did a nice job balancing that that good news that came out about the economy. So on that note, let's
manage to depress everybody else.
So let's move on. On Tuesday, Catherine Gregg, the longtime companion of Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger, was sentenced to 8 years in prison. She pleaded guilty to crimes associated with harboring Bulger, who eluded authorities for 16 years. Here's U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz.
This was not just a mere harboring case. This is a serious case where Catherine Gregg committed serious crimes. She helped and protected and concealed a fugitive, Whitey Bulger.
Now here is Catherine Gregg's attorney, Kevin Reddington.
She was and is in love with Mr. Bulger, and she's certainly a person who does not regret what she did in living her life with him. As I say, she's, you know, he's the love of her life.
So, Joan, what do we think? Does the sentence fit the crime?
Well, first I would say, you know, some girls like bad boys, but that's a little bit to the extreme. I think the lawyer, you know, going off on the idea of a great love story and Shakespeare and all that, that wasn't a great argument to make. I agree with the prosecution in this case. It wasn't a love story. She made a choice, and some of the choices involved crimes. You could argue about 8 years. Was it, you know, should it have been less? Basically, I think it was a fair sentence.
You know, I'm wondering, John, that statement about no regrets, could that have had an impact on the sentence? I mean, this sort of statement of no regrets.
It's very possible. I mean, it's like parallel universes here. Catherine Gregg's sister says she's guilty only of being attracted to the wrong kind of guy. It's like they're living in a completely different universe. I think that probably the victims of Whitey Bulger's alleged crimes are probably the best barometer for this, and they seem to think that that justice has been served with Catherine Gregg. So I think from that standpoint, it was a good sentence, a good decision. I'm just wondering how many, you know, movies of the week are going to come out of this thing. I mean, you can, across the cable spectrum, you can put something on virtually every cable outfit, from Home and Garden television to Lifetime. It's an amazing sort of collection,
sure,
of characters and of events.
Right. If she had watched anything that, you know, came out after the Sal DeMasi case, I mean, part of his issue was that he never said, "I'm sorry, I'm responsible." And, you know, she got up and basically did the same thing, just no acceptance of responsibility. And I think that does factor into the thinking.
Well, the Gregg sentencing, certainly a sideshow to the trial of Whitey Bulger, which is scheduled to begin in November. Still, the Gregg sentencing was a huge media event. One can only imagine how big this November trial is going to be. Right, Joan? I mean, what are they going to have to do? They're going to have to sort of rope off the whole Seaport area.
Bigger than big. I mean, you probably need a ticket to get in.
I think it's going to be one of those events that is going to be blown so far out of proportion that it's going to be really hard to get a sense of what's the reality here and what's not the reality. I think that the hype is going to do a disservice to the public in the end.
I fear that you're correct about that. Well, let's move on to our weekly hubbub, that story that sort of didn't quite make it above the fold that's worth observing. Joan, let's start with you.
Well, this may not have made it because it's of interest to journalists, but there was, I thought, an interesting story involving the museum in Washington, D.C., and a speech that Mitt Romney gave that was sponsored by something called the Business Roundtable. And the press was actually, you know, kicked out of the museum, which has a 75-foot-high, you know, accolade to the First Amendment, you know.
Right, this is a museum essentially the history of the American press, right?
Right. Yeah. And the same thing happened when Obama spoke and was hosted by the same group. But I just think it's kind of sad and really wrong for, you know, a museum dedicated to journalism to do that to the press, and they should be called out on it.
But interesting that it wasn't an issue when Obama did it. It is an issue when Romney does it.
It should have been for both.
Yeah, I agree.
John Carroll, your hubbub.
My hubbub is actually literally below the fold. It was in the Thursday Styles section of the New York Times. It was about Ann Romney, the headline, writing her own dress code. And I have to read you this one sort of Faulknerian sentence here. Wearing breezy wrap dresses, form-fitting shes, or mismatched prints that cautiously flirt with runway trends, Mrs. Romney, a seemingly traditional candidate's helpmate, nonetheless turns her back now and then on the nondescript cardigans and milk carton suits that are standard camouflage of women on the stump.
Badly in need of editing.
I don't know if this says more about Ann Romney or the New York Times, but you really should do yourself a favor and read it. It's got blouses with an agenda. It's got her having a more than peripheral awareness of fashion. It's a joy from start to finish.
So just so we can tell listeners where to find this, this is the New York Style section from...
This is the Thursday Style section from the New York Times, yesterday's New York Times.
We have provided a link at RadioBoston.org, I am informed by my able producer, Dan Mozzie. Okay, here is my hubbub. Who can forget the Red Sox, Bill Buckner's heartbreaking error, Game 6 of the 1986 World Series?
Little roller up along first, behind the bag! It gets Bill Buckner! Here comes Knight, and the Mets win it!
Right, we remember. Thanks to Vin Scully, it went through his legs. Nobody can forget it. And apparently not even a group of middle schoolers in Kenya. And this all is the fodder for a video that has gone viral. It turns out that they reenacted the final inning of that famous game, including the infamous heartbreaking error by Buckner. The Kenyan students wanted to make a movie about a famous American sporting event. And after watching a bunch of real clips, they voted on Buckner's historic error. So they reenacted the whole thing. They used a tennis racket instead of a baseball, but they hit the ball up the first baseline, through his legs. They reenacted the celebration of the Mets and the utter dejection of the Red Sox. The video has gone viral. You can also find a link to that on RadioBoston.org. And it makes me sort of sad because Bill Buckner is such a nice guy. He would like so much to have this behind him, but it just keeps going and going and going. And now, it's an international phenomenon. So what are you going to do?
Well, he was just welcomed at the 100th anniversary of Fenway. So I think he might have gotten past it.
I think it's right. Not enough that they win the Boston Marathon every year, right? But they got to go after Buckner, too.
Unbelievable. Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks so much for coming in and have a great weekend.
Thanks.
And John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University, author of the Campaign Outsider blog. John, good weekend to you.
Thanks, Anthony. You too.
Stay with us. Up next, the Roxbury International Film Festival and the lessons of Boston's busing crisis. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.